Trevor Dan's company. I second that emotion.
From 1967, that's I Second That Emotion, that's Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And I'm delighted to say that we can welcome to the studio America's greatest living poet, as he was once described by no less an authority than Bob Dylan, a man also celebrated in song by ABC, surely one of the great names in American popular music. Smokey Robinson is here. Smokey, hello.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Just to get something out the way very quickly, why Smokey?
Smokey is a name that was given to me when I was probably 3 years old by my favorite uncle. My uncle's name was Uncle Claude, and he used to take me to see cowboy movies, and I loved cowboys. And he had a cowboy name for me. He called me Smokey Joe. And at that age, when anybody asked me what my name was, I told them Smokey Joe. My Uncle Claude said my name is Smokey Joe. So when I got to be about 12, they just took the Joe off, and it's been Smokey ever since. And most everyone in my life has always called me that, with the exception of my mom and dad, who call me Junior. So that's where that came from.
Were you always a singer? When did the songwriting kick in?
Well, I've always sang all my life, so I understand, from my two sisters and my mom before she passed. I came out of the womb singing in the house and about, and I've really always tried to write songs. The first song that I ever wrote that anybody ever heard, I was about 6 years old, and I was doing a play at my elementary school, and we had a class called auditorium, and we did plays, and I was in a junior glee club and stuff like that. And my auditorium teacher had written this little melody for the beginning and the ending of the play that I was in. And I asked her if I could write some words for it. And she said yes. And so I did. And the night of the play, you would have thought from my mom's reaction that I was Cole Porter or somebody like that, because she was very proud of that. But that was the first time I tried to write a song that anybody heard.
Because the thing about this is that in the 50s and even the early 60s, really pre-Beatles, pop singers didn't write their own songs, did they? You know, the crooners of the day, the Frank Sinatras of the day, chose other people's songs. So it must have been quite bold for you as a young man to say, no, I've written a song, I can do that.
Well, yes, especially when I first started listening to music, the singers ordinarily did not write their own songs, which is where the songs from the Timeless Love part of the CD comes from. So I think that just before I came along and started, there were a few singers who were writing their own material, like Chuck Berry and Fats Domino and people like that. So I came in on the beginning of an era and on the tail end of another, I guess.
Let's talk about one of the most famous songs that you wrote now. You Really Got a Hold on Me was covered by the Beatles. I think for many people in the UK, it was probably the first time we heard of you was when they covered this song. And it's one of the songs that it's credited only to you. It's not a co-write. Can you tell me how this song came about?
Well, You Really Got a Hold on Me was inspired for me by, I had a bunch of singing idols when I was a kid growing up. Jackie Wilson was my number one singing idol, and Sam Cooke was running a very close second to him. And so Sam Cooke had a record out called Bring It On Home to Me, which was a bluesy type record. And I wanted to write something for the Miracles in me like Bring It On Home to Me. And I was a vice president of Motown at the time, and I had gone to New York from Detroit to close a business deal we were doing with another publisher in New York. And I was in my hotel suite one evening, and I started to write the song You Really Got a Hold on Me, which was a similar type of song as Bring It On Home to Me. And the first thing that I came up with, which caught my attention from myself, was I Don't Like You, But I Love You. And I just went on from there to write You Really Got a Hold on Me.
You really got a hold on me.
Really got a hold, baby.
I love you, and all I want you to do is just hold me, hold me, hold me, hold me.
The bit I really like in that is where you do that, I want to hold you, pause. tighter. And I remember first hearing John Lennon singing that and thinking, you know, it was almost written for him. It's a brilliant idea, and it's not a conventional piece of songwriting.
Well, you know what? When I write a song, I always try to write something different. There are no new words. There are no new subjects. There are no new notes or no new chords. And so you have to work within the framework of what is already there, what's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years of language. So I just want to say it differently, because I try to say it differently and add some different touches to whatever it is that I'm going to write. And the one thing that I loved about the Beatles is that the Beatles, they were the first white group or the first white act that I had ever heard to say that they grew up listening to Motown records and they grew up listening to black music. And I thought that was so honest of them. And I was very flattered when they recorded "You Really Got a Hold on Me."
If you ever get a chance to go to Detroit, it's worth going to see the original Motown building, which is pretty much, it's exactly what you don't expect it to be. You'd think it would be some kind of rather grand building, and it is in fact just a house, isn't it, with a cellar. And all these wonderful records were recorded by you and all your colleagues. It looks as though it must have been the most amazing environment, most amazing creative environment to be in. Is that how you remember it?
Well, Motown to me is a once in a lifetime musical event. It happened like that when we were doing it. It had never happened like that prior to that time, nor do I think it will ever happen the same way again. And the original Hitsville building that you're speaking of was our original recording studio. It was a house. Berry Gordy, who is the founder of Motown, bought this house on a street called West Grand Boulevard in Detroit. And he bought the house because there was a garage attached to the house in the back. And so we tore the kitchen out of the house and made that the control room and put a big glass window in between that and the garage became the recording studio. And that's where 85% of our records were recorded.
Was it like a family, Smokey? Were you kind of, you know, bumping into Diana Ross on the stairs, that kind of thing?
When you hear about the Motown family, that is not a myth. That was actually how it was. And you mentioned Diana Ross. I had known Diana Ross since she was probably about 12 years old or so. She lived four doors down the street from me, and she always wanted to sing. She was very close to one of my nieces. My oldest sister happened to raise me after my mom passed when I was 10. My oldest sister came back to the house to live there, and she had six kids at the time. She ended up having 10, so there was like 11 of us. And my nieces and nephews are actually like my brothers and sisters. And one of my nieces was very close with Diana, and she used to come to our house all the time. And she always tried to sing, and once I started to sing professionally with the Miracles, she had her group. She had moved away by that time and moved to a place in Detroit called the Brewster Projects, and she wanted me to hear her group. And so they came over to sing for me, and at that time there were four of them. There was Diana and Florence and Mary and a girl named Barbara. And I thought they were very good, but Barry would not let me record them or sign them up to Motown until after they graduated from high school, which I did. As soon as they graduated, I signed them up and I started to record them.
And here's the very famous and very brilliant Tracks of My Tears.
So take a good look at my face. Oh, you see my smile. Yeah, look a little bit closer and see
Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the Tracks of My Tears. I suppose you've heard a million times the story of how that song influenced Pete Townshend and The Who.
No, I've never heard that story of how the Tracks of My Tears influenced The Who. Please tell it to me.
Well, you know the way you sing, although she may be cute, she's just a substitute. Pete Townshend has said that he wrote his song Substitute because he wanted to have that word in a song because he was so influenced by the way you sang it.
Well, that's really nice to know that Pete did that. I didn't know that. Yeah, that's very nice. That I got the inspiration for the song from my guitarist, who is still with me today, Marv Tarplin. And he has been the source of so many songs for me because he puts his music on tape and he gives it to me and I listen to it until I can come up with a song idea for whatever he's played there. And the Tracks of My Tears started with the chorus for me. I had Take a good look at my face. You see my smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easy to trace. And I went through all kinds of things. It's easy to trace that I miss you so much, or that I love you, or that I'm sorry you're gone, and all that. I went through that. And one day I was just thinking about, what if a person had cried so much until their tears had actually left tracks in their face? And if you looked at their face closely, you could see those tracks. And so that's where the tracks of my tears came from. And like I said, the source is my guitarist, Marv Tarplin.
What I think is terrific as well about songs of that sort that you wrote is that, unlike perhaps the Temptations and the Four Tops, where almost all of it is ensemble singing, what you used to do, the Miracles, is pull words out. They go outside and then you sing a line, and then they go inside and you sing a line. Was that stuff that you were bringing to that? Were they your arrangements?
Well, basically, I did the lead vocal arrangements, and sometimes I did that, but the Miracles were very adept at doing background vocals and stuff. So a lot of that stuff was their ideas.
Who had the idea for the orchestral fairground motif at the beginning of Tears of a Clown?
Tears of a Clown was actually, that track that you hear on that recording was given to me by Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder and a guy named Hank Cosby had done that musical track, that very same track, in the studio, and Stevie brought that track to me. And he said, "Smoke," he said, "I've got this great track, and I cannot think of a song to go with this track. So I want you to listen to it and see what you can come up with." And so I did, and the little thing in there, the little calliope pipe thing, bum, 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 ba-da-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, is from the Circus. That is a circus melody from hundreds of years ago. And when you hear that melody, you think of the circus, at least I do. And I wanted to write something about the circus that I thought would be touching to the average person. So I thought about Pagliacci, who was the Italian clown who made everybody happy. The kids, the grown-ups, they all came to the circus to see Pagliacci. And then when he went back to his dressing room, he was very sad and lonely because he didn't have a woman who loved him. So he cried. And so I thought about the average man or the average woman going through that same thing about their lover, or no one to love them, or their lover's gone. So on the outside, they're very, very happy and putting on this happy face, but on the inside they're crying. And so that's what the Tears of a Clown is about. Just like Pagliacci did, I try to keep my sadness hidden, smiling in the public eyes, but in my lonely room I cry for tears when there's no one around.
I did want to ask you about, you mentioned being a vice president of Motown. You were there at the very beginning of Motown with Berry Gordy. How much did the business side of Motown, do you think, detract from the creative process of being an artist and a writer?
It never did, because of the fact that when I met Berry, I had a bunch of songs that I had written, and I knew who he was, because I had all of Jackie Wilson's records, and Berry had written all of the hit songs for Jackie Wilson up to that point. And I met him quite by chance at an audition that the Miracles and I had gone to. We weren't called the Miracles then, but we had gone to this audition for Jackie Wilson's managers, and Berry happened to be there that day to turn in some new songs for Jackie. And we sang five songs that I had written rather than anything that was currently popular by any artist. And this caught Berry's ear because he was sitting in on the audition, and I thought he was waiting to audition because he looked so young. I thought he was just waiting there to audition after we were done. And so the managers rejected us because they said we were four guys and a lead singer singing high, and we had a girl in our group, and there was already the Platters, who were very popular, and we'd never make it. So we went out dejected, and Berry came out behind us to find out where we had gotten the songs from that we sang, because he had never heard them. And he introduced himself as Berry Gordy. So right away, I was flabbergasted because I had all of his music, because I had the songs that he had written for Jackie Wilson and Etta James and people like that. And so he and I struck up a relationship and a conversation, and he actually was very instrumental in teaching me how to craft my songs professionally. And then about a year or so after that, we started Motown, and the rest is history.
Did you sit behind a big wooden desk. Did you have your office? Was there a kind of Mr. Robinson will see you now kind of feeling about the way you were VP?
Well, yeah, I had a desk. I had an office and I had a secretary out front and all that. Being a vice president, I had all those things. But when I became a vice president, actually, my duties or my work corporately did not change because I had been there from the very first day. And, you know, the very first Motown record ever was on the Tamla label on an artist named Marv Johnson. And Barry and I had gone to get the records when they were first pressed up and taking them around to the radio stations. And, you know, there were five people at Motown. There was Barry and four other of us. And so we did everything. So it was not a new thing for me to be a vice president, and my office was basically for inducting new talent and signing them in once they came to Motown and coordinating their schedules with producers and writers if I was not going to do that with them myself. So it was a very easy job for me because it was what I was into musically, and like I said, the corporate things were just going on like they always had. It just so happens that one morning in about 1963, officially crowned me as vice president, but my job was the same as it had always been.
Let's move on to the 1980s and hear Being With You.
I don't care what they think about me, and I don't care what they say. I don't care what they think. If you're leaving, I'm gonna beg you to stay. I don't care if they start. What they do, I don't care about anything else but being with you, being with you.
Being With You, Smokey Robinson from 1981, song you wrote on your own, at least there's no other writing credit on that one. I remember vividly working for BBC Radio 1 when that came out, and a fellow producer saying to me, do you remember Smokey Robinson? And yeah, of course I did. He said, I thought he was washed up. Have you heard this? And you know, there's a real sense of revelation that you had been, we thought, kind of away for quite a long time. And Being With You was just such a great record. It was so modern for, you know, it was absolutely the sound of its era. Great record.
Well, thank you very much. Being With You is a song that originally I had written for Kim Carnes. Kim Carnes had a huge hit on a song of mine, More Love. And when I heard her version of More Love, like I do many times when I hear one of my songs by another artist, I will write some other songs for that artist and try to get them to them. And so I had done that in Kim's case, and I didn't know how to contact Kim, but I did know how to contact the guy who produced the record on her, a guy named George Tobin, who had a studio in Los Angeles. So I went to George's studio to play the songs that I had for Kim, and when I started to play Being With You on the piano and sing it to him, he told me, he said, Smokey, I really would love to record this song on you because it's for you. And so I went back and forth with him for 20 minutes about, no, I wrote it for Kim and all that. So he finally just told me, he said, okay, I tell you what you do, you come to my studio tonight and we'll make a demo record for Kim. I said, okay, fine. So I went to his studio that night. He had his musicians there, and we made what I thought was a demo record for Kim. And I sang it down a couple of times, and then he let me hear it. He said, now, do you not think that this is a hit on you? So I said, oh, yeah, I think this is a hit on me. And so the Being With You that became number one all over the world was originally a demo record for Kim Carnes.
That's a great story. What's it like being a musical legend and being produced by young people? I mean, are people perhaps too respectful of you and they don't actually work with you, or are they tough enough to say, I think we need another take on that, Smokey?
Well, you know what? People talk that legend stuff. I don't look at myself as a legend. I'm a very blessed man. I get a chance to live a life that I absolutely love. I can't think of anything I would have prefer to do with my life other than what I'm doing. So I'm blessed, and I've been around a long time, and that's another blessing. But when I'm in the studio, I make it clear to anybody that I'm going to work with, this is your baby. Whatever you want to do, whatever you hear, whatever you think, present it to me, because I'm open. And I want it to be what you feel as well as what I feel. So I don't close myself down, and I let them know from the very first moment, do not be afraid to say whatever's on your mind when you're working with me, because that's the only way we're going to get the best product.
Here's Smokey Robinson's My World.
Now I don't know a lot of pretty words to say, but love speaks louder than words anyway. I want to tell you my I wanna tell you my word. Listen.
For somebody like you, who is such a well-respected songwriter, what's the attraction of interpreting other people's songs?
When Cole Porter wrote a popular song, all the artists of that day sang that song. I've heard each one of these songs by so many different people. As a kid growing up, you know, like Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Billy Eckstein, Sammy Davis, Patti Page, all these people sang those same songs at the same time. And so I've heard these songs all my life, and I've sang them all of my life. And professionally, I've added them to our concerts. Every time I've done a concert for about the last 14 or 15 years, I've included at least one or two of those songs.
Well, let's have a listen to You Go to My Head.
You go to my head like a sip of sparkling burgundy pool. And I find the very mention of you like the kicker in a julep or two.
Before we let you go, just to go back to the Motown, the family as you described them, do you still see Berry Gordy and you know, the Supremes and the, you know, that those people, do you still ever hook up with each other?
Well, I still see Berry Gordy a lot of times because he lives right in Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles and I live in Las Vegas also. But Berry is my best friend, so we see each other all the time. And I still see the Motown artists too. And see, the great thing about the Motown artists and the Motown family thing is that I told you earlier, it's not a myth. There was a family type of atmosphere at Motown. And when we see each other, meaning when I say we, the Motown people, it could be years since you've seen each other, and there's no reacquaintance involved. There's no getting to know you again involved. It's just like you saw them yesterday, and we hug and we talk and we're very comfortable with each other, and we will always be family.
Let's finish, if we may, with Shop Around, the first big Miracles record.
It was the very first million seller that we had, and it's a song that took me about 30 minutes to write. And originally, I had written it for Barrett Strong, who was one of our Motown artists, who had a huge record on a song called Money, That's What I Want. And I had been assigned to do an album on him, and I wrote Shop Around for him. And then when Barry heard it, he wanted me to sing it, so I sang it. And Shop Around is very interesting because I had recorded it on the Miracles and Me, and about 3 weeks after it had been out, Barry called me at 3 o'clock in the morning and said, hey man, I can't sleep because I'm thinking about Shop Around and I want to change the beat and the sound, and I want you to get the group and come to the studio right now so that we can do that. And to make a long story short, we did that, and that's the one that became the first million seller.
It's always a pity on occasions like this that you can only do an interview and not make, you know, a 25-week documentary or something. It's been fascinating talking to you. Thanks ever so much for coming in, Smokey Robinson. Thank you. Here's Shop Around.
Thank you very much.
You better shop around.
Trevor Dan's company. Get in touch. Visit trevordan.com.